Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Lucy Dallas is here again this week, weighed down by the relaunch of our new website, but being pluckily northern about it. Lucy?
Hello. How are you doing? Like Atlas?
Yeah.
Not really. Well, having a better time than Atlas.
Yeah, it didn't turn out well for Atlas.
No, it didn't.
From memory.
So scratch that.
We've redesigned the paper. And we've got the same, which is in shops and in people's hands this week, mm-hmm. but we are the beginning to do a beta version of your website.
Yes, we are. My website.
It's your website.
Nobody else can look at it. It's just mine. No, we
are
doing
it. If it goes slowly at this stage, it's your website. If it starts to really ramp up in terms of the redesign, it'll become all our websites.
It's very much a joint project. Yeah, yeah. We're starting to roll it out this week and it will have new added wonderful things. Every week, I think.
Yeah, until it becomes a sort of very beautiful, very functional thing.
Yeah.
Beauty and functionality.
That's what we're all about.
It's the dream, isn't it? So you really should be subscribing to the new TLS. If you get a paper version, it's already redesigned. If you get a digital version in the next couple of weeks, it's going to look really lovely, I promise. You can get a cheap subscription, actually. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. And if you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. £5 or $5 for 5 issues. I really hope you like what we've done with it. And coming up on this week's Old Look, New Look show for the New Look TLS, we've launched a book imprint as well as doing all this with 2 books. One is by thriller writer Lee Child, a non-fiction account of the development of the hero, and the other is a collection of essays by TLS veteran Virginia Woolf. We'll talk to the editor of the book series, Ros Dineen, and our literary editor, Michael Keynes, about Virginia Woolf in the TLS. Woolf once wrote an essay in the TLS about George Eliot, and we've used that as the beginning of our appreciation of Eliot, who would be 200 next week. We're also running a lecture by Professor Rosemary Ashton about Eliot's philosophy, and she'll be in the studio to discuss the career of this great figure. And talking of great figures, how about the boss? Bruce Springsteen, of course. Karen Rose will be on the line to testify to his universal appeal. Virginia Woolf once wrote this: 2 things I mean to do when the long dark evenings come, to write on the spur of the moment, as now, lots of little poems as they may come in handy, and to collect, even bind together, my innumerable TLS notes to consider them as material for some kind of critical book, quotations, comments, ranging all through literature as I've read it and noted it during the past 20 years. Well, it may have taken us 80 years, but we've obliged her, as we're publishing this month a book called Genius and Ink, Virginia Woolf on How to Read, a collection of Woolf's writing on Bronte and Eliot, James and Conrad, and so on. It has a preface from Ali Smith, who calls Woolf a writer for whom everything is invested with life and death and the imagination it takes to read and write both. And an introduction from Bloomsbury expert Francesca Wade, who calls Woolf's reviews works of literature worth reading and rereading in themselves. So what does the book show us about Wolf the writer and reader? Literary editor Michael the Dr. Keynes, who helped shape this collection, and features editor Ros Dineen, the editor of TLS Books, are here to talk it over. Hello.
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 And Ros is throwing coffee all over the place as
Sorry.
Well. Sorry. And actually staining Michael's copy of our brand new book. Let's talk about what it's like to read Virginia Woolf today. You've both read all of these essays more than once. What's it like? How have they aged? How do you feel when you read them? Do they feel of their time or a little more timeless than that?
They do feel of their time. It's quite strange. They are of their age. Obviously, she is writing about writers we just think of as classics of English literature, but they are living and working and dying in her lifetime. One of the things that Francesca Wade mentions in her introduction is that there's a sort of long gestated piece about Thomas Hardy that Bruce Richmond, her editor at the TLS, sort of asks her to write well before Hardy dies. You know, it's years in the making, 10 years in the making, I think, Francesca Wade says. But basically it's asking her to think constantly about Hardy, his place in the canon, to reread his books. And so you can sort of see that coming to fruition when the piece finally appears in 1928 after Hardy's death. So on the one hand, they're of their time, but to me at least, I've completely ready, delighted to be contradicted. There is something quite fresh, exciting about them. They're very easy reading, I think. There's something enjoyably sort of largo about the pace at which she expounds a point.
Absolutely. I think they are... they feel so fresh still. Even though I've read them now...
Too many times.
Loads of times. There's a line in one of them. She's talking about Elizabethan playwrights.
Yeah.
And she talks about them and she says... witnessing the Elizabethan plays, it's as if thought plunged into a sea of words and came up dripping, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But that is a similar experience to reading these essays.
And it seems she was allowed to sort of stretch out a little bit. You know, she's allowed to build metaphors, she's allowed to have style. There's a style in all of this, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Which we try not to crash out of. I mean, there's a tension when you're running a weekly magazine to try and make everything fit and work, and it can... crush style a bit, can't it?
Yeah, and it seems to me that the story of the relationship is that Wolf has only really just started out as a professional writer when she meets Bruce Richmond, who had wanted her father, Leslie Stephen, to write for the TLS. And it's a year after Leslie Stephen died, who had taught her. She'd basically had a Cambridge Don on tap to walk with and talk about books constantly, and his guiding lesson about reading was, you know, never pretend to admire something you don't admire, always follow your own opinion. You can see that coming through in that work. And although she wrote hundreds of pieces, particularly over the first two decades, I think she writes something like maybe 90 odd pieces in the first decade, and then maybe 140 the second decade, and then it tails off a bit after that. But over that, she's writing short pieces as well, but I think there's a relationship of trust there.
Yeah.
So that what you're describing, where she gets to stretch out and he trusts her to write the piece about Conrad or the piece about George Eliot's centenary, is partly, you know, is one of the benefits of having that kind of long-term good editorial relationship.
It feels very much like the kind of thing we have now. You tend to, you know, you might start someone off on a short book, and if they do a brilliant job, you give them some more and you think, oh great, they're reliable, and then you throw things at them, and then after a bit they're, you know, you say, let's get them to write this great big
do piece. You or do you keep them down? Sorry,
that's you. That's just you, Michael. But she turns out to be, I mean, that's the amazing thing, that they have that relationship, and she turns out to be one of the great writers of the 20th century that they have that relationship with. And what struck me about reading Francesca Wade's piece was actually being a TLS writer, amazingly, was important to her development as a writer, not only in terms of style and what she's thinking about, but this notion of living by your pen. There's that bit where the first check she gets is delivered with the breakfast things, and she says, now we are free, because she shows she can do it. And, you know, for the person who then writes A Room of Her Own, the idea of you needing this freedom, this space to be a woman writer, it's clear she kind of got that to whatever extent at the TLS.
And there's something as well in Francesca's Wade piece about the deadlines that she had to work to, and how that actually enables you to just get it out there. Because she had to write these TLS pieces, she had to complete the thoughts, complete the work, and that fed into her longer books later on.
I'm very fond of the idea of deadlines being a spur of creativity. Mm-hmm. The idea that Shakespeare was Shakespeare because he was a hack. He could have been off in an ivory tower producing a play every 5 years, you know, every word laboured over. But the the brilliance of Shakespeare was that he was writing to a commercial deadline. He had to make these plays. He had to keep writing them, keep writing and writing them.
It was quite practical, wasn't it? Because he knew who he was writing for and what audience.
And there is an element of that, isn't there? Where the genius and the hack is how I always consider Shakespeare together. And clearly, she was moving in rarefied circles, I presume, relatively early anyway, wasn't she, Wolf? I mean, she was... When did the Bloomsbury set become the Bloomsbury set?
The period when she starts writing for the TLS is also the period when Old Bloomsbury, as it's sometimes called, started to be formed around the sort of Stephen family. When they moved from Kensington after her father's death and her mother was already dead and Stella Duckworth was already dead, so that her old life had sort of fallen apart, and she and her family were remaking it. So it is this time of extraordinary change, and they are meeting these extraordinary... This is the time of meeting Strachey and J.M. Keynes.
So it's the beginnings.
It's the beginnings of Bloomsbury as we think of it. But that pre-war decade has got a very distinct sort of flavour of its own. And they're being daring and they're rejecting sort of tea table talk, although they're very good at it, and sort of going out in society as their sort of stepbrothers wanted them to do. That's actually reminded me of something that's not in this collection because there are so many short reviews she wrote. But I love to rescue these things from these short reviews she wrote. And of course she knew Rupert Brooke and she sort of swam in the river at Grantchester with him, as you do. Yeah. And but she said something about him. A lot of time you're reading these reviews and there's something that, or essays, and Francesca Reid, I think, quite rightly says you can read them in their own right and they're great and they should be read in their own right. But it's every now and again you think, oh, that comes back to something in her own work. And I feel that there's a little bit of a sort of meta-commentary going on. She's always thinking about how you think about books. And when it comes to Rupert Brooke, of course, she's writing about him anonymously, but you still feel that she knows him really well. And she says that he's talking about the way he reads. His judgments were not only very definite, but had a freedom and a reality which marked the criticism of those who were themselves working in the same art. You felt that to him, literature was not dead nor of the past, but a thing now in process of construction by people of many of whom were his friends. And that knowledge, skill, and above all, unceasing hard work were required of those who attempt to make it. To work hard, much harder than most writers think is necessary, was an injunction of his that remains in memory from a chaos of such discussions. I mean, so much of that seems to apply to the way that she relished, as you say, having a deadline, getting a book, writing and rewriting it that week.
And that's what led to her. And where did she get the confidence from? Because it strikes me that before she was and it's anonymous anyway, but before she was a big name novelist, she was casting confident assertions about other, and these were the titans of the age she was dealing with often, wasn't it? It was Conrad and James, and these are big figures, and she had the confidence to wrestle with them.
I think it's just because she was always, from reading these essays, you get the idea, she was always just trying and trying and working on landing on a true sentence. And I think because of the work she put into that, that in itself justified, gave her confidence.
To go back to the Room of One's Own, I mean, I'm not just being facile about it, but maybe the checks helped to give her confidence. It's a real validation. Mm-hmm. I bet we all remember the first time we got paid for a review in the TLS.
Yeah.
I
mm-hmm.
do, not very much. But the point is that you get paid for it. So someone said, yes, that's
it's probably about the same amount.
It's almost certainly the same amount.
And was it, I mean, you couldn't live on it. Could you live on it? Could you live in the days of the 30s? Could you live as a reviewer, Michael, do you think, as a way of...
It sounds like you could.
It sounds like... I mean, she had money though, didn't she?
I think there's been some interesting work on this and how, in a sense, people could live this way. Not necessarily very well, but certainly if these are the works of the left hand and with your other hand you're hoping to write your great novel, it is viable, certainly more viable than it is now for all the reasons with which I think we're familiar.
Is there a feminist tinge to these writings? It's notable that she's writing about often great female figures. You know, there's Bronte, there's Eliot, there's Elizabeth Browning. Is there a sense she's trying to articulate something about the female voice in this, or does she just write about the whole range of literature, do you think, with no discrimination?
I think the latter. She is as hard and fair and generous on all of her subjects quite equally. I'm not sure there is that sort of feminism that we'd recognise today in here.
Do you think people want to see that in her? That, you know, this is her championing female voice? She's doing it at a time where at least, you know, as famously, the TLS used to have more clerics writing for it than women. They don't seem very political from what I've read these essays. Is that fair, do you think? Is she ever making an argument, a broader argument, than just responding to the text?
I think she's sometimes making I'd almost say she's more spiritual than political. I think she's sometimes making a broader argument for the human soul, if that's not too grand a statement, than she is for kind of worldly, everyday, changing political subjects.
And it probably isn't too grand a statement, is it, Michael? Because that's presumably she believed passionately in the importance of what she's doing, the importance of literature. She probably make claims for its soul. Soulfulness.
Yeah, I think so. She's writing as somebody who's absolutely dedicated her life to it, who was sort of destined from the age of five by her family to be a writer in some sense, who, you know, was the only formal education she really had. There are other elements, but she basically got herself lessons in Greek at King's College, London. She had the run of her father's library, obviously. And the circle she's gathering around her are people who are going to sit and talk about books with her. So it's a sense that, yeah, this is absolutely the world, you know, the foundation stone, I think, for her. And that's maybe why you get that kind of equal opportunities brilliance. It's really interesting to read her, I think, on female forebears as novelists, you know, George Eliot, obviously, and Charlotte Bronte. I think the piece in this book, Genius and Ink, about Aurora Leigh, is an absolute knockout. It's incredible. And when it comes to dealing with the social side, the circumstances of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's life and how that shapes the work, that's vital. But then she can write equally well about anyone. It's absolutely wonderful to read. And if you go scattering through the archives, you find more and more of it. It's astonishing.
And she's a sort of great enthusiast, isn't she? I don't mean she doesn't like everything. She's very discerning and can be stern.
Well, there's that great line about my real delight in reviewing is to say nasty things,
yes.
Isn't there? But actually, it's good, isn't it? It's good fun. I think a lot of us have felt that.
Yeah, we need a bit more of that, I keep saying.
But I think there's
the general thing.
Sorry, yeah.
No, I was just going to say that the general feeling you get is that, yeah, as you say, she cares about it so deeply that she makes you think, yes, we do have to do this.
That's
a great enthusiasm.
Can I quote a bit about this from the book? An essay she wrote on Montaigne. It is not fame that he wants. It's not that men shall quote him in years to come. He's setting up no statue in the marketplace. He wishes only to communicate his soul. Communication is health. Communication is truth. Communication is happiness. To share is our duty, to go down boldly and bring up to daylight the most hidden thoughts which are the most diseased, to conceal nothing, to pretend nothing. If we are ignorant, to say so. If we love our friends, to let them know it. I mean,
that's a manifesto for living, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. And that's what I mean about she's making these incredibly grand statements in what are essentially book reviews, and she pulls it off every time.
And the real world matters to her, Michael, doesn't it? That sometimes, you know, the idea there's nothing outside the text is not something that she agrees with. That, you know, I was very strict with the George Eliot piece. She really begins and ends with wrestling with George Eliot's status as a woman, as an equine-looking woman that sort of still stares out of the page, her position in life, and then how that is transmuted into the fiction. She kind of has this sort of new historicism. She cares about the circumstances of the writers.
Yeah, it's almost as if they've stolen that trick from her, isn't it? That she thinks you can only understand the work through knowing how it came about, you know, Montaigne's circumstances, or George Eliot's, you know, woman writing as a man. And here is Virginia Woolf writing anonymously and having the discipline to do it week in, week out in this incredible way.
How nostalgic are we being about this? Do we think that, you know, this is a writer writing book reviews who turns out to be one of the great writers of the 20th century? In 50 years' time, I'm not saying necessarily about the TLS, but do we always look back? I've said this to you before, I think, Michael, that, you know, in the 1960s you could have Nabokov writing and you'd be like, amazing, we have Anthony Burgess, or you could have Iris Murdoch, and they feel like, how amazing to have these great figures writing normal journalism. And so is that rosy-tinted glasses looking back, and in 50 years' time, do we think that the same thing will be happening? Or was there really a kind of golden age? Because she's moving in some circles and talking about writers that have just died, you know, Hardy and James and Conrad. There feels like there are moments where there's a peak of talent.
What do you think?
I'm not going to keep
quoting.
It's really long. Yeah. But in How It Strikes a Contemporary, which is one of the essays in the book, she says almost exactly what you were just saying. She's just like, this age is meagre in terms of critics. We're on the verge of destitution, and how will everyone judge these books in 100 years? They'll probably forget them all. There are no good critics.
Yeah.
She says it very well.
But are they good? Are there great authors? I mean, are there great author critics? Because there's a period, obviously, where you could have Virginia Woolf writing criticism. You could have Thomas Hardy writing stuff. I mean, do you look back and think that there was a golden age, or is it just that's just the way that the world?
I mean, cumulatively, I think you get the sense. I think they speak to one another very, very nicely. But then I would say that because I helped choose them. But you know, she's very concerned with what I'm calling, you know, the canon or the classics, but how they speak to contemporaries, you know, and how you read contemporary books is partly shaped by how much you've read of the past. You know, an expert reviewer needs obviously to be able to say this is something new, or this is exactly the same as the last umpteen adventure books, or whatever it is. And she's not snob about, you know, reading different genres. She's obviously really interested in biography, she's really interested in adventure, but she's also really interested in what Henry James is doing. So she is a kind of literary adventurer. And whether I you know, you could say there's a kind of golden age from our point of view or from hers, I think one thing that this book would possibly be able to testify to is that this is the making of the TLS. Is that it's not so much about what this paper, what Bruce Richman did for her. Yeah. It's that this was a very new paper, finding its voice, and the proprietor at the time wasn't above, you know, shutting it down. It was a small, relatively small thing.
Yeah.
It could easily have gone, couldn't it, within 10 years? I mean, the average lifespan of literary journals is not massive. So, in a way, giving her the space to do this incredible thing week in, week out, it's a more important relationship for the paper than some of the other, you know, well-known writers like T.S. Eliot.
That's Virginia. Virginia Woolf, Genius in Ink, Virginia Woolf on How to Read, and Lee Child, the Hero. The first two books in a brand new imprint called TLS Books, and we have five next year.
We have five next year.
Which we won't talk about specifically, but five equally interesting books as well. Rosdanine, Michael Caine, thank you very much indeed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Virginia Woolf wrote a centennial essay for the TLS about George Eliot and noted, "One cannot escape the conviction that the long, heavy face with its expression of serious and sullen and almost equine power has stamped itself depressingly upon the minds of people who remember George Eliot so that it looks out upon them from her pages." Henry James, for example, called Eliot magnificently ugly, deliciously hideous. In fact, it's hard to think of another writer so famous for both greatness and a sort of unnecessary assessment of her looks in the way that Eliot has been. Lena Dunham once called Eliot's Wikipedia page the soapiest, most scandalous thing you'll read this month. Thesis, she was ugly and horny. There you go. But as we now reach the bicentennial of her birth, the greatness at least remains undisputed. Woolf's essay ends with an injunction to lay upon her grave whatever we have in our power to bestow of laurel and rose. So we're doing that in the TLS this week, including with a lecture from Rosemary Ashton on the subject of, appropriately enough, coming to conclusions. She's with us now in the studio. Rosemary, hello.
Hello.
It is amazing how many people, including Woolf and James, and there's lots of other contemporaries, they kept harking back to to Elliot's appearance. It's a strange thing, isn't it?
Well, it is a strange thing in a way. It's a bit unkind, actually. Henry James is very, very... I've looked into this. He's very ambivalent about it. When he writes, he's writing back to his parents when he first meets her, and she's a great author, and he's just the young American going along to pay obeisance to her on her Sunday afternoon reception. And he's writing back to his parents, and he's actually very, very keen to show to his parents that he's meeting all the great people in London. His father is financing his trip and is always asking him why he's spending so much money. And so he wants to show that he's become part of the London literati. And one way of doing this is to make sure he sees George Eliot and then writes a long, long letter back home to Boston to his parents, explaining and describing. But James is already... He wants to be a writer. He's not yet a writer. He's a young man in his mid-20s. He wants to be a writer. This is in 1869 when he first visits George Eliot and Lewis in their house, the Priory, in Regent's Park. And he wants to be a great writer. So he sort of... And he wants to impress his parents, also with his writing ability. So he sort of puts himself on a pedestal vis-à-vis her, while at the same time expressing his, you know, bowing and scraping to this great genius. So actually, he's doing a kind of naughty, double-edged thing. She's magnificent but ugly. She's, you know, not very forthcoming, and yet her voice is very musical. And she does, he does that kind of, on the one hand this, on the other hand the other, all the way through his description of her.
That sounds like a very Jamesian thing, of course, to do. Your piece is about George Eliot's conclusions.
Yes.
And that has two meanings.
Yes, that's right. It's obvious that you can come to conclusions, i.e. moral or intellectual conclusions, decisions, after an analysis. And we know that George Eliot was a great analytical writer, philosophical writer. In fact, sometimes she's been rather downgraded from being a popular and great writer because she's thought to be too serious. There's some of the things you quoted about her long, serious face. Not just does she not look very attractive and feminine and so on, but she's a serious, sombre writer.
Kind of an anti-Dickens in a way.
Anti-Dickens. And of course, it's not true. I mean, she was a serious writer, but she was also a very amusing and witty writer, and she managed to do both things. But she does like to come to conclusions about human nature. She observes human nature, and she has a view on it and how people behave. So that's that kind of coming to conclusions when she asks, what do we make of Maggie Tulliver, for example, in Mill on the Floss, when she goes off, as it were, eloping with her lovely cousin Lucy's fiancé. And it appears that they've eloped, and it appears that she's a lost, fallen woman and so on. It's not entirely like that, but in fact she has fallen for this young man and found herself in a trance going off on a boat down the River Floss, and then she decides to come back. But George Eliot likes to show you that... it's not unusual, or it's not impossible, for a young woman who also loves someone else, Philip Wakeham, to be in love with two people at the same time, and yet not, you know, not to be immoral or hypocritical or any of those things. And so her judgments, if you like, and this is what interests me about her judgments, is that they are not the kind, not the kind of judgment that actually Dickens will offer you.
Yeah, and yet she's known as a moralist. I mean, she's people always say, "Oh God, George Eliot is a moralist."
Yes, she is, but she's much more open-minded and tolerant. Moralist.
And you say in your piece that she very much has the possibility of at least two things, two contradictory things, being able to hold them in your mind and hold them both as true.
Yes.
Which seems to me to be a very modern position, actually. And as you say, not at all like Dickens, who says, there's a goodie,
there's a baddie.
Yes,
and we're going to give them their just desserts, you know, so the goodies will succeed and the baddies will not. As Jane Austen had also done, actually. Yeah. She does it very openly in Mansfield Park. She says right at the end, well, I've had enough of this, you know. I'm going to finish. I'm going to give those who've not been too much in error or in, you know, I'm going to give them their desserts, really.
And we're therefore talking about other conclusion. It's interesting, in Northanger Abbey she talks about the telltale compression of pages as we're hastening towards felicity, the idea that a book has a shape and there's often a clear-cut ending. Henry James said the whole of anything is never told, you can only take what groups together. And often his endings aren't quite as conclusive as Austen or Dickens. Eliot's more like that, isn't it?
Yes.
There's less of a wrapping up because life is never wrapped up.
Yes, that's right. And that relates to her view, which we know from her. She was an extraordinarily good literary critic before she started writing novels. And we know from her, the best of her articles in the Westminster Review, that she believed in realism and she believed that novels should not be a matter of escapism and that it's not a moral ending to have the good always survive and flourish and the bad be punished, because life doesn't do that to people. And so that's why her conclusions are very much a much more delicate, balanced sort of conclusion than some of the other writers.
And you also say that quite often she has a little bit afterwards. So there's what we think is the ending, and then she comes back and says, well, let's have a think about this.
Yes, she does that. I mean, and that, I think she can do that because all her novels, apart from the last one, Daniel Deronda, which is extraordinary in many and modern in many ways, even more so than her other novels, but all of the other novels are set back in time. So they're historical novels, not all like Romola way back into Renaissance Italy, which is not her greatest success.
I want to talk about that because I read it this year.
It's not her greatest success.
No one likes
it. I'm very proud because he's read it.
Do you know what? I read it and I mentioned it to TLS people.
Yes.
They never admit to not having read something.
Not having read it.
And no one had read it.
No.
And one of them said, of course I've read Romola, and then came back 10 minutes later and went, no, I meant Daniel Deronda.
Yes, yes.
Because it's a historical novel.
Yes.
Is it a lost classic, do you think? It has its moments, doesn't it? There's some beautiful moments.
It's got some beautiful moments. And if you want to see how George Eliot deals with the elucidation of motivation and character and the difficulties of coming to decisions and conclusions about a person's character, read Romola for the young man Tito Melema, who's the Greek who comes. He's got nothing. He's well-meaning. He's handsome. He's good-looking. And he's sort of slides. She shows him sliding into...
And he's not a proper baddie, therefore, is he?
He's not a baddie, but he ends up compromising himself and not being able to get back from it.
But there's an issue in Romola, isn't there, where she was so desperate for realism that the whole of the book is thickened by this endless quest for accurate detail to make sure the calendar is exact. Do you think that's an issue with her book? Because it seems to me that realism, more than moralism, is kind of a good governing... factor in the work.
Well, it is, and the dangers of realism are that you merely simply, write out reams and reams of it was like this, it was like that, it looked like the other. Actually, her partner G.H. Lewis, who was also a good critic, has a word for that, which is coat and waistcoat realism. And he says, it's not what we want.
Yeah.
We're not after just endless descriptions not going anywhere. We want a kind of realism of psychology, for example, but also of context. And I think she succeeds with setting her characters into their historical context, because all the English-based novels are set back to either 1800, Adam Bede, or around about 1830, Middlemarch, Felix Holt, and so on, when she was a young woman, or a girl, rather, and growing up in the Midlands, and where she will actually look at her own history. But also, she read. She sat in the reading room of the British Museum and read widely on... the Reform Act and the Lancet, the new medical journal, the Lancet for Middlemarch and so on. But she also, of course, read for Romola. And her reading for Romola, unfortunately, gets into the book too much.
It strangles her, doesn't it?
It gets into the book.
You can see it in this. Yeah. At the beginning particularly, because at one level, the setup of Romola, it's set in Savonarola's Florence.
Yes.
And at one point, you think this could be a Dumas-style romp where there's a kind of a father returns and he's been wrongfully enslaved, and they're sort of quite adventurous. You like Dumas, don't you? This is not like that though, because she pulls back from that, doesn't she?
Yes, she does, because I hate to say it, but it's adventure painting by numbers, isn't it? You can see a mile away that this young woman is going to be abused by the count or whoever it may be, and you just know what's going to happen, and whereas she does not do that. I mean, she doesn't stoop, if you like, to that. But she does. I mean, it was Henry James, of course, again, in one of his sharp moments, said in one of his review of Romola, in fact, that it smells of the lamp.
Did Henry James James not have any non-sharp moments? Because everything we've quoted him as saying has been
he was constantly trying to elbow his way in, wasn't
he? Yes, that was it, you see. That, yeah, if you do that. Read his letter to his parents after meeting George Eliot for the first time, you see that he's motivated. He's motivated by his own extremely strong desire to make it as a writer himself. And he was one of those people, I mean, he was dossing around, actually. Yeah. You wouldn't think that of Henry James, but, you know, he'd given up university. He was going to do law, and that didn't do, and so on. And so he didn't have a job. He didn't have a profession. His parents were a bit disappointed. Yeah. And so he was busy trying to muscle in. And then, of course, he was clever, undoubtedly. And you could see he had some valid points to make about Middlemarch, about George Eliot, about other writers, Balzac and so on. He's terrific. But at the same time, he's motivated sometimes by jealousy or envy, and sometimes by a kind of sardonic negativism, a desire to put these great people sort of in a corner, in a box in some way.
Because also it took him a while to get going. So if you think that, when was his first great big novel? I mean, Portrait of a Lady is really middle. He's been at it for a while.
But that's the first successful one,
Yeah, and his early ones are a bit footling in some respects. So you could probably imagine him thinking, I feel great.
Yes.
I'm not quite great.
And when you read Portrait of a Lady, who do you see looming behind it? You see George Eliot. Because it borrows such a lot from Daniel Deronda in particular, where the young woman is preyed upon by a rather opaque, cruel man. As happens to Gwendolyn in Toronto.
And I wonder how much did he acknowledge the debt?
Well, he didn't. Would he? No. Not directly. Or at least, I always feel as a biographer, I always feel you have to be very careful. You can't say so-and-so never said or never wrote something. We simply don't have any evidence that you
know. That's very reasonable. It's 200 years of Eliot. So this is going to be a big month of Eliot.
Yes.
Which is good. You'll be talking about it a lot, talking about her a lot. Where do you feel she is now? Funny, if I was asked to do this thing on the BBC of 100 novels that shaped our world, which was about very personal decisions. It wasn't the world, it was sort of individuals' world. But Middlemarch did get on it in a way that some classic novels didn't.
Yes.
Do you think we're coming... Virginia Woolf was writing 100 years ago. Yes. We're now 200 years since the birth. Where is Eliot now, the standing of her, do you think?
Well, her standing is very high, I think. And I think certainly... How would we know that? Well, we know it partly through university syllabuses, really. I mean, she is there, you know, in spite of the fact that these days we're told students don't read long books and you can't set long books. Undoubtedly, Middlemarch is there on most English department syllabuses. Yeah. I certainly taught it for nearly 40 years, very happily, and students very happily read it. That's the other thing. But you also find that the general... so the laity, as it were, not professional academics, but an educated laity, always turns to Middlemarch. They do turn to George, but Middlemarch rather specifically, rather than George Eliot generally, I think.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I was trying to think, is there another novelist for whom there is, who wrote prolifically and well, or semi-prolifically and well, for whom there is one novel?
Yeah.
Because the laity, as you say, will have read Middlemarch.
Yes.
How many of them will have read Mill on the Floss? None of them will have read Romola, as we've discussed. But I mean,
they wouldn't have read Annabeed either, which is her first novel and is remarkable for a first novel. But they might have read Mill on the Floss because it tends to be a GCSE text.
Lucy, what have you read of
Mill on the Floss?
Yes.
I think, and Middlemarch and Daniel Deronda, which I remember taking me. I read it a long time ago.
Yeah. But Middlemarch seems to stand above everything, doesn't it?
It does. That's partly because people like Henry James acknowledged, however slightly grudgingly, that he said it put a limit on the 19th century English novel. And of course that in itself could be read two ways.
Yes.
You know? Oh, is she at the end of a dying old...
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
A nail in the coffin.
Yes. Or is she right up at the top and nobody can go any higher?
A lot of people would say it is the greatest Victorian novel.
Well, I would say so, lot of people would say so.
Yeah.
In fact, I couldn't remember... Last year, because I've been working towards various events for this... bicentenary. I've been collecting praise of George Eliot or comments on George Eliot. So, as you probably know, the Saturday Guardian has a writer talking about the books that made me, and you know, and Middlemarch comes in there quite a bit. I don't know if I should say this, but Salman Rushdie actually said that it was the book that he couldn't finish. And I thought, well, crikey, you know, how can the author of Midnight's Children, of all books, say he couldn't get through Middlemarch? However, but most, a lot of them do say Middlemarch is the very one that they find wonderful. Thomas Keneally told the Sunday Times a few years ago that he thought Middlemarch was the greatest novel of all time about human relationships.
Yeah.
And it had never been outthought and outwritten as what he wrote.
There are people do still read lots of Dickens, but with Middlemarch there is a difference where you feel like you are in touch with another consciousness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? With Dickens, there's so many characters and fantastic things to enjoy, but Middlemarch you feel like you have really sort of almost made contact.
Yes. Well, you've
someone.
In both of them you've entered a world, but in Dickens's world, a lot of the characters, and I'm not going to go straight for the idea that they're caricatures, but they are not seen in the round, to use E.M. Forster's phrase. They're not seen into.
No.
The only characters he gets into the head and heart of are his young men, Pip in Great Expectation,
David Copperfield,
and so on. He doesn't try with the others. They come on and they're set pieces.
Yeah.
That's how they will be.
Sort of theme park approach.
Yes,
a little bit.
That's how they will be from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Whereas with George Eliot, she really, really, if she doesn't actually get inside the head and heart of every character, even the minor ones on the periphery of a large panoramic scale like Middlemarch, you know that she could.
Yeah. Well, Rosemary, I challenge anyone to listen to you talking about Georgia and not want to go off and read some. I'm going to go and reread Middlemarch, I think. Rosemary Ashton, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
The story is one that has no borders and is as ancient as dirt. We're not talking about Legends of Greece or Gilgamesh or Camelot. We're talking about the boss, not Stig in this case, but the boss of us all, Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
He released a film last month, Western Stars, to go with his album of the same name. And this, along with his autobiography and the related Broadway show, looks a lot like someone looking back and defining his legacy. Karen Rose writes about him for us this week, reviewing a book of essays and Western Stars itself. Karen, many thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Can you tell us about this essay collection, Long Walk Home, and particularly about what sort of contributors it's got?
This collection is compiled by an editor, June Skinner Sawyers, who's done a few essay books on Bruce. Their thesis was, the best people to determine the impact of Bruce Springsteen were the fans, were his audience. So there's a lot of personal experience. They do say in the introduction that deadlines prevented them from getting a more diverse pool of contributors.
Do you buy that?
That's an unusual excuse, isn't it?
I buy it as somebody who understands deadlines, but I think it's a weak excuse. I think that they were trying to tie it to his 70th birthday, and that's not a deadline that moves.
But women are as available as men to a certain extent, aren't they? I mean, it's not...
Absolutely. I think that if they needed to get more people, there are certainly many, many more people that write about Bruce Springsteen than the individuals that are represented in the book.
Yeah.
And they also ran a very old Grail Marcus piece, which, great, Grail Marcus is one of the great thinkers about popular music, but there was probably somebody who isn't as well known but is as thoughtful that would have been available and delighted to contribute.
Is he seen as very male? Because at one level he's seen as very blue collar, but is he seen as someone who is a man's man, rightly or wrongly? Is that a sort of cliche about him?
I do think that that is definitely the cliche in America. I know that I find his audience in Europe and the UK to be have more women in it, and it skews younger. But definitely in the US, people think of him as the man's man. So many people were incredibly, when I say people, I mean old white men, were very crabby when he married Patti Scalfa and had her in the band. And, you know, my take on that is they go to see Bruce to relive their youth, and having the wife on stage doesn't let them do that. Yeah.
There's even a song about that, Glory Days, isn't that a Springsteen song where he talks about men looking back on their time when they were athletes and they got all the girls, and there's a sort of hint of nostalgia about that all.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
But there's also a couple of contributors that you mention, a racial justice activist and someone writing about being a Springsteen fan as, a, as she defines, as a queer woman. And they have very different perspectives, don't they?
Yes, and I'm so disappointed that since they made the bold step of finding these contributors that they couldn't find more. There was actually another essay written by an LGBTQ Springsteen fan that came out in the States last week. And, you know, there's the perspective is, it just broadened your appreciation of his music and his contribution every time you can see it through a new lens. Again, it shows that there's just, there's no shortage of voices that are not old straight white men.
He's struggled a bit, hasn't he, in the sense that he seemed to represent this blue collar mid-state type of perspective, but he's a liberal man, and therefore his audience might be sort of pro-Trump fans, and he's very much not that. And there's been a tension between him and his audience to a certain extent. He confronts us about that thing a bit in his book, that he doesn't quite know. He doesn't want to. He wants to speak in the voice of some of his fans, but he doesn't necessarily agree with where they're going politically.
So I think that if you've listened to his music since he started and you somehow thought he was on your side,
yeah.
When I say your side, I mean a Trump supporter, I would say there's definitely some cognitive dissonance going on there.
Yeah.
When he supported John Kerry, you know, he talked about how somebody mailed his entire album collection back to him. And, you know, there's definitely fans of his politicians. Chris Christie, you know, has seen over 150 Springsteen shows. They're seeing in it what they want to see in it. I remember there was an article about Chris Christie where they talk about, you know, Bruce says nobody wins unless everybody wins, but he's not really thinking about this in the right way. And it's pretty clear. The statement's pretty clear. I don't know how you can find any shades of grey there.
But look at Born in the USA. That's often used at rallies as a sort of patriotic hymn to kind of Republican market forces. And of course, that's not what the song's about at all. It's not a hymn to the greatness of the America. It's an investigation into it, isn't it?
Several people yesterday were talking. It was Veterans Day here in the States, and there were various parades to celebrate our veterans. And the reports of how many of these parades were using Born in the USA was, you know, every political cycle, I start saying, could somebody hand out a lyric sheet? could we just like have a glance at, I mean, you know, this goes back to Ronald Reagan misappropriating.
Yeah, I remember that.
Bruce. There's an evergreen essay I could write about this and just change the names of the politicians.
Yes, the various misinterpretations. But as you say, what Natalie Adler says in her essay, she's talking about Born to Run. That spoke to a lot of people. Born to Run for all sorts of reasons. I've got to get out of here because, you know, I'm not accepted in the community, or because
Trump's,
you know,
like
I need
us.
To, yeah, exactly. And that's what she says. So, and that's it, some of his genius in a way, isn't it? That actually he is so identifiable.
Yes, and I think that's something he absolutely aims for. You know, he talks about this at the end of the Broadway show, that he hopes that his mission has been to tell everybody's stories, and that he hopes that he's done that. And I think when he's saying that, I think he's saying, I hope you see yourself in my work, because that's what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a bit of Western Stars. We're going to listen to some of the lines that you quote in the piece. It's a lovely Springsteen vignette.
Once I was shot by John Wayne, it was towards the end. That one scene's brought me 1,000 drinks, set me up and I'll tell it for you, friend.
So it's a lovely, it's the kind of persona, isn't it, that he's kind of getting people to buy him drinks in a bar.
the character in that song is he's, you know, this fading star, or not even star, but sort of bit player in Western movies who's, you know, dining out. One of the lines is, you know, the commercial about the credit card.
But musically, you say it's a bit of a departure, isn't it? It's much more country inflected than he usually is, and it's got these big, lush arrangements with lots of strings.
It's not with the E Street Band either, is it? It's him.
No, yeah, it's him and quite a big band. And you say it's reminiscent of some of the great 60s and 70s American songwriters like Jimmy Webb or Harry Nilsson. In fact, he does a cover of Rhinestone Cowboy, doesn't he? Which was not written by Jimmy Webb, but very famously Glenn Campbell did it, which is that's a bold move.
Yes, and I did not know that he had done that. When I went to the press preview of the film, at the end that comes on, and it's like I was both delighted and laughing because, like, of course he would do that. You know, do Wichita Lineman next, Bruce. Like, there's a long list here if we're going in this direction.
Yeah, and it has to be said that he sounds amazing, especially considering that he's 70 years old.
Yes, he sounds amazing and fantastic, and it's a voice. He's got a great rock vocal. He does have a great soul kind of growl, but he's never used this sort of wide open voice before, and it's wonderful and astonishing, and I wish we had a chance to experience it live.
It's interesting, this album was released the same day as Madonna's new album. And you know, it's interesting to think about how the album's received, the fact this Broadway show he's doing. You know, these are both massive figures from the 80s particularly. But whereas Madonna's album was sort of seen as experimental and not warmly received, this was more warmly received. It's just an interesting that he just seems to be in being embraced even more, ever more tightly.
Yes, I think that the Broadway show and then the end of the last tour where he was just breaking his own records for how long he was playing... I liken it to Patti Smith's reception after Just Kids. You know, before Just Kids, she had her core group of fans. But then after Just Kids, everyone who read that book suddenly was like, oh, Patti Smith, I should go see her. She's still touring. And you had more of the casual fan, the I like music, but I may not have paid attention to this closely enough for the last 10 or 20 years.
And in terms of the film, because the Western Star is not only an album, but it's a film, as we were saying, is it basically a lovely set of performances, or is it more than that? Is there a narrative?
There's a narrative, which was kind of unexpected, at least for me. It's tied together with these beautiful images. You know, Bruce says he wasn't behind the camera, but Tom Zimney definitely knows how to capture beautiful lighting, beautiful images. You could call it, they used to have these things in the 70s and the 80s called electronic press kits in the music business, which was, you know, a VHS with some clips of the artist talking and some live footage. This is more than that.
It's like the world's most expensive and beautifully produced version, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And Bruce wanted, you know, he stated he's not touring this collection of music. It's him just making, you know, he can control, like, this is the message. I'm sending this message out. This is what I want to say about these songs. I don't have to sit for multiple interviews around it. I can say what I want to say about the songs. I can make sure I have the best performance of the songs that I can render. Here we go. Western Stars.
Yeah. So it's a closed package. He's giving it to us as is. Many thanks for joining us, Karen. I feel it's appropriate here to play out with a moment from his lovely song, Sundown.
Wonderful.
And that's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Rosemary Ashton, Roz and Michael, and Karen Rose. Lucy, it's been a joy.
Thank you for having me.
Go back to your website.
I will.
Please, if you do like the TS, go out and get your hands on either a subscription or a real copy of the new design. I do hope you like it. And by all of your family, a real book by Virginia Woolf. Next week, we launch the next book in the series, The Hero by Lee Child. And on the podcast, we'll be talking about all sorts of other things too. Thea may even be back if she can be bothered. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.